rather imperfect communication mechanism. So I think I basically know what he did and what he didn't do, but there may be some overlap. And just yell at me if I'm overlapping too much. And, you know, if I'm assuming, seem to be assuming something he didn't say, you can yell at me about that, too. So, sort of, you know, when I entered the field back in, way back in the 80s, there were sort of three big conjectures which motivated the study of at least of infinite volume hyperbolic three manifolds. Of course, there was Thurston's geometrization conjecture, which was sort of a big motivation for finite volume hyperbolic three manifolds. And one of the things we're going to do in this mini course is just talk about the solutions of all three of these conjectures, which have all happened in the last 3 or 4 years, giving sort of you know, something of a completion, not a total completion, but a completion of a good part of Thurston's program for the understanding of spaces of hyperbolic three manifolds. So let me write the conjectures up on the board. Probably Jeff already did this, but it doesn't hurt to remind ourselves where we're going. So Marden's tamest conjecture. This just appears to be just a rather, maybe even a little bizarre, purely topological conjecture. And it says that if N is a hyperbolic three manifold with finitely generated fundamental group, then this implies N is topologically tame, which means homeomorphic to the interior of a compact three manifold. Well, yeah, that's true. But I mean, it appears to be purely about a topological property of hyperbolic three manifolds. But one of the things I'm going to do today is to tell you what some of the consequences of this seemingly quite topological conjecture are. Now, there are, of course, topological and group theoretic consequences, but there are also geometrical and dynamical consequences of this conjecture as well. So we'll talk about that. The second big conjecture was Thurston's ending lamination conjecture. And it says that N is determined up to isometry by its homeomorphism type and by its end invariance. Okay, so this is a complete classification conjecture for hyperbolic three manifolds. In particular, one knows exactly which end invariants can occur and which end invariants cannot occur. And these end invariants just capture the asymptotic geometry of the three manifold. And there's sort of hidden in this is an application of the tameness conjecture, because in fact, to define the end invariants, you need to know that your three manifold is topologically tame. So already there's something geometric going on there. And then the third conjecture, and you see this with various people's names attached. Let me just put all of them here. Baer-Sullivan-Thurston density conjecture. And that just says that any hyperbolic three manifold is a limit of geometrically finite ones. Oh, and all my hyperbolic three manifolds, I'm going to forget to write it most of the time. They're all going to have finitely generated fundamental group. You know, nothing is true about hyperbolic three manifolds with infinitely generated fundamental group. Well, that's something of an exaggeration. But is a limit of geometrically finite hyperbolic three manifolds. So this is something you'd obviously like to know. You define geometric finiteness, right, Jeff? Geometric finiteness is sort of the most classically understood and easiest to analyze hyperbolic three manifolds, and then it's natural to want to be able to study an arbitrary one as a limit of ones you understand. And in fact, that's the way much of the progress on the tameness conjecture went. First, it was proved for limits, and then it was eventually proved for all hyperbolic three manifolds. Though in its actual proof, it goes sort of backwards. You prove the tameness and both the tameness and the ending lemniscate conjecture are used as inputs to prove the density conjecture. So in fact, you first have to prove they're nice to prove their limits of nice things. So, though I guess Ken at the conference can talk about an approach with sort of short circuits that a bit. Or no, you're not. You're going to talk about ELC, you're not density, right? What? Okay. So let me set up a little notation. So, you know, hyperbolic three manifolds are just quotients of H3 by groups of isometries. It's going to be useful to have the domain of discontinuity. So this is largest open set on the Riemann sphere on which gamma acts discontinuously. You know, once you have the group acting discontinuously, you naturally take the quotient. So this is called the conformal boundary sometimes. You take the domain discontinuity and you mod out by the group action. And this is the sort of boundary to infinity, natural boundary to infinity for your hyperbolic three manifold. So you often sort of, you know, sort of append it on there. You take H3 union the domain is continuity, mod out by the group action. You just get the conformal boundary. Okay, and just for setting up notation for later, you know, it's natural when you look at where the group action behaves nicely in the Riemann sphere, it's also natural to look at where it does not behave nicely. That's called the limit set. Okay, what else do we got up here? And then another very natural object which Jeff talked about, so I won't go into much detail about, just to remind us all this stuff. This is the convex core. And this is, take the convex hull of the limit set, and you mod out the group action. You can define it more qualitatively just by saying it's the smallest convex submanifold which carries the fundamental group. So, but it does have this very concrete description, and in fact, the convex core is homeomorphic to this manifold where you take the manifold and throw its conformal boundary on, and just remind ourselves of the definition. And is geometrically finite if this convex core has finite volume. And the case we're mostly going to look at is where it's actually compact, because we're going to sort of very early on assume that our manifolds have no cusps. So, okay. Do you talk about the geometry of the complement of the convex core? Okay. So, just remind ourselves, the complement of the convex core, so you have something like this, you have the convex core, it has this product structure, so if you look at n minus its convex core, that's equal to the boundary of the convex core cross the half line, and the metric is just cosh squared t times the metric on the boundary of the convex core plus dt squared. Well, to be honest, it's by Lipschitz to that. Okay, so at least from the point of view of sort of getting a coarse understanding of things, we understand the geometry of the complement of the convex core quite well, and one of the challenges which goes into Thurston's ending lemniscate conjecture is to try to understand the geometry of the convex core, which is more mysterious. And that's where all the interesting both topology and geometry happens in the manifold. So let's see an example of what could the geometry of the convex core look like. So let's see. Did you do the three-manifold fiber of a circle? No, good. Is it annoying if I keep asking every 5 minutes? Or only annoying to Jeff? Anyway, so just to get a. What? Who is? I think I'm outside the jurisdiction of the, you know. So the anyway, so the simplest example, well, maybe not the simplest example, but if you believe a major theorem, the simplest example of a three-manifold which fibers over the circle is to take the surface cross-I and glue the top to the bottom by some homeomorphism, and if you choose your average homeomorphism, then the result will be hyperbolic. That's a consequence of well, a special case of Thurston's geometrization theorem. So let's believe we've done that, and we've made a hyperbolic manifold of this type. Well, then, if you pass to the cover associated to the surface subgroup, well, this is made by taking a Lego block and gluing the top to the bottom, and then the cover is made up from infinitely many copies of that Lego block, top glued to bottom, glued to top, glued to bottom, etc. It looks something like this. It's just a surface cross R. They call that N, call that M. And each of those Lego blocks is geometrically the same. One thing you'll see that's very different from the geometrically finite case, here, everything in the world grows exponentially or decays exponentially, right? I mean, hyperbolic is the most overused word in all of mathematics, but you always expect to see exponential decay and exponential growth somewhere there. And it's sort of puzzling that here you see very linear growth behavior of almost anything you want. And in fact, there's an apocryphal story that when Thurston was asked if these three manifolds could be hyperbolic, he said no, because look, this has linear volume growth. That couldn't possibly be hyperbolic. It's sort of a good plausibility argument, but it turns out to be rather false. But let's sort of abstract out, what feature of this does Thurston abstract out as being a feature that you're going to always see in a geometrical infinite manifold? And well, if you take, say, the surface and you pull it tight and you get, say, a minimal surface here, then you're going to get that minimal surface. It's going to be a hyperbolic surface in that its intrinsic curvature is always going to be at most minus one. But you're going to also see infinitely many copies of it going out. And it turns out that that's going to be the key characteristic property of our geometrically infinite hyperbolic three manifolds, is that the ends are going to have a product structure, like this manifold has a product structure, and they're going to have a sequence of surfaces going out the end whose intrinsic metric have curvature bounded above by minus one. Okay. So let's now talk about tameness. And oh, I want to bring up sort of a second kind of tameness, which is geometric tameness, and a lot of ways is the geometric tameness that we care about more than the topological tameness. And the key point is that it turns out that for hyperbolic three manifolds, they're actually the same thing. So let's assume so you can say this various ways. You can assume the gamma has no parabolics. Or you can say that n has no cusps. Or you can say every essential curve in n is homotopic to a geodesic. So if you take a rubber band and you tie it around something in your three manifold, you let it pull tight, it will pull tight to a geodesic. It won't go winging out to infinity like it would in a cusp. So let's just assume that that's going to make, for nothing that we say today, will it be an essential. So the presence of parabolics can make a quite essential difference, but in nothing that we're doing today will it make an essential difference. Okay. So, I think Jeff told you this, that there exists a compact submanifold. This is due to Peter Scott. There exists a compact submanifold C of N, such that the inclusion of C into N is a homotopy equivalence. So, and that's your guess for what the homeomorphism type of the manifold ought to be. What would you like? You'd really like to be able to choose a compact submanifold such that the complement, all the complementary pieces had a product structure. So that's what you expect to be true. Oh, well, I call convex core C of N in this C. Okay, so that's... Would you prefer R? We can do R. Let's do R. We'll do R. Okay. So, you know, we have this picture here. You know, you've got some manifold. And there's some compact thing R, and you're hoping this has a product structure. That each of these complementary pieces has a product structure. Well, that's too much to hope for, because even if your manifold is topologically tame, you could choose a compact core so that the complement didn't have a product structure. So, for instance, suppose your manifold were a handle body like this. You might choose your compact core to be some knotted thing. Some knotted bouquet of two circles in there. The complement would eventually have a product structure, but the entire complement of the compact core would not be a product structure. So I guess formally you would have to thicken that bouquet of two circles up a little bit into a three submanifold. So we're not actually going to prove, or I guess Juan's the one who's actually talking about the proof. One can't actually prove that the complement of the compact core has a product structure. Okay. So, one can be a little bit more formal about what the definition of ends means, but let's think of an end as just one of these complementary pieces. We're just going to call this is an end out here. We could carefully define that, but let's not. And we say there's two kinds of ends. It'd be good if your end were geometrically finite like this. Well, then eventually there'd be this product structure and you'd win. That'd be good. So we'll call an end geometrically finite. And I'm being lazy, I'll just call that GF. If it has a neighborhood, which is outside the convex core. So maybe as you look out in one of these directions, you see a boundary component of your convex core, and you see something nice like that going on. And so that's good. That's certainly topologically tame, and maybe you look out this end, and there's also a nice boundary component of your convex core. And you look, and everything's fine. But maybe when you look out here, this entire end is contained within the convex core. Well, and then what? Well, Thurston proposed, well, not quite this definition, but we'll use his notation. The end is simply degenerate if, first of all, it has a neighborhood U which has a product structure. So we build the product structure right into the definition here. And there exists a sequence. And these are all going to be closed surfaces, closed hyperbolic surfaces. Such that first of all, Fn goes to infinity, so these are all going to be in U. And they're all and Sn, they're all on the same homotopy class. So Sn is homotopic to a level surface, and it's important, but let's not really get into it, that that homotopy lie within U. So you want them to be homotopic, not going through the manifold, but in the product structure on the end. And it turns out if you want to do things like prove all fours measure conjecture, you really need this. And I may say something about that tomorrow. I'll take a vote. We'll see what people want to hear. Okay. So let me draw a picture of that. So you got some product structure, and you have these surfaces. S1, and notice also I draw them with a little curlicue. That's to remind you, we don't really care if those surfaces are embedded or not. Okay. Do you want me to define the word hyperbolic, or do you, are we happy with intrinsic curvature less than minus or equal to minus 1 as a definition? Well, so Thurston used pleated surfaces. Bonahone used simplicial hyperbolic surfaces. You know, if you're in Caligari-Gabay's proof, you get these shrink-wrapped surfaces, which are another kind of object. Minsky showed that you can use images of harmonic maps. There's a lot of different types of surfaces you can restrict to here. And the only important property is that their curvature be bounded above by a negative number. Should I say more? Okay. Oh, so intrinsic curvature of Sn is less than or equal to minus 1 in sense of Alexandrov. Well, here, let me give you, so let's just, your simplicial hyperbolic surfaces might come up again. They get used all the time. So let me give you an example. How do you build pleated surfaces? Are beautiful things, but they're a little bit harder to think about why they even exist. Simplicial hyperbolic surfaces you can use, and it's easy to see why they exist. So what do I do to build a simplicial hyperbolic surface? So what I do is I take a point on there, and now I'm going to build a triangulation of my surface. You know, I need to add a few more. I triangulate my surface. I map that in the homotopy class of the product structure. And what do I do? So simplicial hyperbolic surface. Means there exists a triangulation T of S such that, well, every edge goes to a geodesic, segment, and all triangles are totally geodesic. And angle about vertices, total angle about each vertex, is at least 2 pi. So if it's more than 2 pi, you get sort of concentrated negative curvature. But here's how to build these surfaces. What are you going to do? I'm going to take this surface, I'm going to map it in, and I'm going to take some arc. I mean, some arc which starts this vertex and goes back around that vertex, I'm going to say, take that loop to a closed geodesic. And then once I've done that, I know where all the rest of the edges have to go. They have to go to the geodesic arcs in their homotopy class, and then I pull each of the triangles tight to be totally geodesic. Now, since this is mapped to a closed geodesic, the angle around this way is at least pi, and the total angle around that way is at least pi, and you get a total angle of at least 2 pi. And so you're... That's a way to guarantee that you get this intrinsic curvature less than or equal to minus 1. So, and you can assume that all these surfaces are simplicial hyperbolic, if you like. It's a very concrete way of going about it. Pleated surfaces do get used in the proof of the ending lamination conjecture. In the discussion of the tameness theory, you certainly don't need them. Simplicial hyperbolic surfaces is still, simplicial hyperbolic surfaces work really well if you're in a fixed manifold, and pleated surfaces work really well if you want to look at sequences of manifolds. So that's roughly. I don't want to get into a long discussion of what a pleated surface is. Maybe it will come up later. What do you mean? Oh, yeah. It's because in Thurston's original definition, what he said is that there just exists a sequence. So in Thurston's original definition, he says there exists a sequence of simple closed G6 going out the end. And once you have a sequence of closed G6 going out the end, which are homotopic to simple closed curves on S, well, then you can just use this construction to build the sequence of surfaces. But the problem is that, and then you can use that to build the product structure, and that's what Thurston did, but that only works if your compact core is in compressible boundary. And if your compact core does not have incompressible boundary, you really need this slightly more complicated definition. So the word simple in there seems a little funny now, but I'm following Thurston's original notation. Is homotopic to a level surface within the neighborhood of the end.
Within that end.
Within the end, you're right. So think about the case where you're a handle body. You could have two surfaces which are homotopic to each other within the whole handle body, but wouldn't be homotopic to one another through the end. And that turns out to be an important technical point I was trying to ignore. I think the word degenerate, this is our sort of history, but I guess the word degenerate arose in the original Kleinian groups theory. They talked about degenerate groups, and they had degenerate groups and totally degenerate groups. And what they meant is that some end was totally disappearing, because they were looking at it two-dimensionally. And you took a sequence of quasi-Fuchsian groups, you had two components of the Dwayne's continuity, you would pass to a limit. Well, now one of them's gone, you only have one component of Dwayne's continuity, so it just degenerated. And I think that's where the language comes from. And then Thurston adapted it. And the word simple comes from the fact of these simple closed curves. That's where all the language comes from, I think. Okay. So, back to our discussion. So, you now say N is geometrically tame. If all its N are one of these two types. These are either geometrically finite or simply degenerate. So these are going to turn out to be the only two types of ends which exist. Okay, and notice right away, well, the topological tameness of the simply degenerate ends is right there in the definition. And we know that the geometrically finite ends have this natural product structure. So it's very easy to see that geometrically tame implies topologically tame. So it appears to be a stronger definition. So a little bit of potted history here. Bonnehon proved that if the fundamental group of N is freely indecomposable, that this implies N is both geometrically tame and topologically tame. So this freely indecomposable condition is equivalent. It means that the fundamental group does not split as a free product in any interesting way. Any group is the free product for the trivial group in itself. Or equivalently, it means that if you look at our compact core, every boundary component pi 1 injects. Which means that if you take a curve on the boundary of the compact core, if it bounds a disk in the three-manifold, it also bounds a disk in the boundary component. Okay? So that's about, 86? And then in 93, I used Bonnehon's work to show that, in fact, these two definitions are equivalent. So N is geometrically tame if and only if n is topologically tame. So at this point, you start seeing that this very topological definition has geometric content. So then there's a whole bunch of work, starting with Thurston, and then ending up with Brock, Bromberg, Evans, Soto, and finally the cherry on top of this particular line of thought, Brock Soto, says that any limit of geometrically finite hyperbolic three-manifolds is topologically tame. I won't take the time to be careful about the word limit here, because the theorem Juan's going to be talking a little bit about is due to Agol and Caligari-Gabay. They just proved that indeed N is topologically tame. So that's the complete resolution of Martin's tameness conjecture. So let me take a little bit of time and try to convince you why this is important. It has a lot of different consequences, both topological and group theoretic and geometric and analytic. So let me just put a few of those up on the board for you. Ah, yeah, so it's a, what? You're going to do that? Okay. Okay. You're going to probably do it in a slicker way, though. You're not going to branch cover, are you? No. Okay. Canary schmanaria. How it was originally done was you take the manifold, which is topologically tame, pass to a branch, you branch over a geodesic, and get a manifold with freely decomposable fundamental group, and apply Bonehon's theorem to it. That was the original proof. Okay. So one of the first, so the most obvious topological consequence of this, well, it's not totally obvious, but this is the biggest piece of that, of the proof of this, is a proof of Simon's conjecture. And it says that if M is compact, irreducible, that means every sphere bounds a ball. I don't know whether you had that. So if you take an embedded 2-sphere in M, then it bounds an embedded 3-ball in M. And depending on how you feel about Perelman today, you need the assumption that it's geometrically decomposable. And it says that if M hat is a cover of M, with finally generated pi 1, then this implies that the interior of M hat is topologically tame. So for a hyperbolic 3-manifold, that's just a special case of the tameness conjecture. And using some work of Simon and Long and Reed, you can prove it for all manifolds which geometrically decompose. This is an example of sort of the power of these techniques. Using purely topological techniques, they prove things like if you're a cyclic group, your cover is topologically tame in certain circumstances. Trying to get at this thing with topological methods got you almost nowhere, basically. So this is a chalk one up for hyperbolic geometry. Now let's do at least one group theoretic consequence. So one, I maybe don't want to finally just say this one out loud, but gives you actual large class of examples of hyperbolic 3-manifolds with subgroup separability properties, but I don't want to define all that. So let me just give you something I can define. And this essentially follows from work of Susskind and the tameness conjecture, well, and the covering theorem. Says that if N is a hyperbolic 3 manifold, then N has the finitely generated intersection property. If and only if N has a finite cover which fibers over the circle. So fibering over the circle is just a fancy way of saying you've made from a surface cross I by gluing the top to the bottom. And finally, generated intersection property says that G and H contained in pi 1 of n and finally generated implies that G intersect H is finally generated. So there's an example of something which seems purely group theoretic, which comes out of the tameness. Another thing you get, actually, it's used in this, just as a group theoretic, sort of somewhere between group theory and geometry. Okay, so this is really a special case of the covering theorem. It says that if N is closed, let's say if M is closed and N is a cover of M with finitely generated fundamental group, and this implies that either N is geometrically finite or it is a cover associated to a fiber of a 3-manifold covering M. Covering M and fibering over. Be careful, over a 1-orbifold. So either it's one of these examples, like you get a surface, the surface subgroup in the 3-manifold fibers over the circle case, up to finite index, either it's that or it's geometrically finite. This gets used in geometric group theory because then this allows you to conclude that either your subgroup is quasi-convex or it's something very special. Okay. So now let me move on to some more geometric or analytic, depending on how you feel about these things, consequences. So one of them, and these are let me not try to ascribe them specifically. One is all fours measure conjecture. So this has been known for 15 years to be a consequence of the tameness conjecture. It says that either the limit set is the Riemann sphere or its measure is zero. And if the limit set is the Riemann sphere, gamma acts ergodically on the Riemann sphere. Okay. So one thing I was thinking about doing tomorrow is to say something about some of what goes into these geometric consequences. So maybe I'll take a vote at the end, and you can tell me whether you want to hear about that or just hear the entire hour about the N-elimination conjecture. might be kind of fun because this involves studying harmonic functions on hyperbolic manifolds using the Jewish chainless theory. But it's actually pretty simple. So what do we want also? So you also get a characterization of exactly when the geodesic flow is ergodic. So the geodesic flow of a hyperbolic manifold, again, with finely generated fundamental group, is ergodic if and only if the limit set is the Riemann sphere. And, well, let me just combine the next two. This is if and only if N admits no positive, oh, better put non-constant in there, harmonic functions. So, turns out that you can use this theory of Jewish chainness to develop quite a bit of understanding of the analysis on the manifolds. And finally, we want a little spectral theory in there, that the bottom of the spectrum of Laplacian x and n is zero if and only if either the volume of n is finite or n is not geometrically finite. Okay. Interesting. Okay. I was a little worried I didn't have enough to say, but I didn't have written enough notes, but I don't think that's a problem. Do people want to hear about this, the proof of these analytic things, or no? if you're not, I mean, I'm not going to do it now, but I mean on Wednesday. I think so. Anyway. I see a lot of, you think I'm coming to hear another one of your talks, you're crazy looks back there, but okay. Okay, so let me set up some of the Enigma image conjecture stuff. And so let me start talking a little bit about the deformation space, which I think Jeff did, but I'm going to do it in more generality than he did. So there's a basic fact here, which I think Jeff probably mentioned in the quasi-Fuchsian case, but maybe not in greater general than that, due to bears with, you know, well, I think as stated, this is just due to bears, as I'm going to put this definition up right now. And it says that if n is geometrically finite, then it is determined up to isometry by its homeomorphism type. So this is going to look a lot like the ending elimination conjecture the way I stated, by its homeomorphism type and the conformal structure on its boundary. So in the case of a geometrically finite hyperbolic three-manifold, the end invariant is just a collection of Riemann surfaces, or if you prefer, a collection of points in the Teichner space of the boundary. And that's clearly sort of an asymptotic piece of geometric information about the manifold. And so this, Behrs first did this in the case of quasi-Fuchsian groups, where he proved that if you take a surface cross I, you can put any structure you want on the top, any structure you want on the bottom, and you can build a hyperbolic three-manifold interpolating between the two. And then there's a moreover. So actually, the fact that it's determined up to isometry by its homeomorphism type, that's actually quite easy. That's just the fact that the limit set has measure zero, and quasi-conformal maps are conformal if they're conformal on a set of full measure. But the more complicated, well, what? Yeah, so I don't think he connected it to this fact, though. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not swearing for my history of the 60s, since I don't think you know, I'm getting old, but I don't think I was born when simultaneous uniformization was proved. So moreover, any conformal structure arises. So, which is that if you have some geometrically finite hyperbolic 3-manifold, like so, you know, and it has some conformal structure out here. Say that's x1, x2, and x3, then I can go down and I can write down y1. I can come over, well, maybe I can come over here and I can write down y1, y2, y3, and I can make a new hyperbolic 3-manifold which has that conformal structure to infinity. Okay? So that's a very powerful and robust deformation theory in the geometrically finite case. So to formalize this a bit, we can define a natural deformation space. It's natural, it turns out, because you want to, well, for a variety of reasons, but for one reason, because you want to put a topology on the space of hyperbolic manifolds from inherited from a representation variety, it's natural to talk about the space of all March hyperbolic 3-manifolds of a given homotopy type. So we take M, let's make it compact, let's make it irreducible, and we don't want any cusps. So let's say no Z plus Z in pi 1 of M, and we want it to be hyperbolic, so let's make pi 1 of M infinite, not finite. Then you can define AH of M to be the set of representations from pi 1 of M into PFL2C, which are discrete and faithful and you mod out by PFL2C. I mean, obviously, if you have a hyperbolic manifold homotopy equivalent to M, you have an identification of its fundamental group, which is a subgroup of PFL2C, with the fundamental group of pi 1 of M, which gives you this representation. And any representation like this, if you quotient out hyperbolic 3 space by its image, you get a hyperbolic 3 manifold of the correct homotopy type. So these are, this is, in words, marked hyperbolic 3 manifolds. Homotopy equivalent to M. So here, if you're used to Teichmuller theory, this is sort of the marking is in this sort of the same sense as the way you mark Riemann surfaces in Teichmuller space. Well, that's quite similar sense anyway. Okay, and you look at this space. What Martin and Sullivan proved is that N is in the interior of this space if and only if N is geometrically finite and has no cusps. Okay, so I guess that's really Martin, comma Sullivan. Martin proved one direction and Sullivan proved the other. So there's another space here. So this is the space of hyperbolic 3-manifolds of a given homotopy type. But if we're a topologist, we might just worry about, we just want to think about the set of topological 3-manifolds of a given homotopy type. So if you call that A of M, which is just, got to put the word irreducible in there, irreducible. Maybe we don't need the word irreducible if we believe in the Poincaré conjecture. So maybe that's not needed, maybe it is. Irreducible 3-manifold, probably not needed. Irreducible 3-manifolds, homotopy equivalent to M. And then what Thurston's geometrization theorem says, if you have anything homotopy equivalent to M, it also admits a hyperbolic structure. So this is going to give you all the homeomorphism types of hyperbolic three manifolds homotopy equivalent to M. So maybe instead of irreducible, our three manifolds are marked, so should be our topological, our hyperbolic manifolds are marked, so should our topological manifolds be. And you get this big theorem which says that if you look at the interior of this space, it has a bunch of components. It has one component for each homeomorphism type, because if you're in the same component of the interior, you can be joined by a path of quasi-conformal deformations, so you'll always have the same homeomorphism type. And each component, well, what you'd like to write, I'd like to stop right here and say the Teichinger space of the boundary, which is sort of what this suggests. Well, but when you mark, there's a little bit of a fuss here, when you mark the three-manifold, you really only mark the fundamental group of the three-manifold. You don't necessarily mark the fundamental group of its boundary. So you actually have to mod out by some group, mod not M prime, which are isotopy classes of homeomorphisms of M prime, which are homotopic to the identity. But we're going to ignore that. Okay. Let me not start the ELC discussion. Let me just give you a couple examples and we'll stop. I'm supposed to stop at 3 or at 2:50. Okay. Good. I haven't misbehaved yet. Okay. So there's some basic examples here. The first one is that M is a surface cross I. Well, the interior of AHS cross I is also known as the quasi-Fuchsian space of S, and that's just Teichinger space of S cross Teichinger space of S. So that's what came up in Jeff's talk, I think. Then you can take, for example, M to be a handle body of genus G, and the interior of AH of the handle body of genus G is equal to the Teichinger space of the surface of genus G modded out by what's called the trivial homeotopy group. Now, it sounds sort of harmless, but of course this group is infinitely generated, so it's a little disgusting. But it's still the quotient is still a manifold, at least. And then a third example. So, I mean, you're beginning to probably wonder, why did I define A of M at all? There's always just one element. There's only one component. So let me give you an example. I'm getting a little tired of giving this example. I imagine people listening to me are getting a little tired of hearing it. But it is, I think, the best example to illustrate the phenomena of when there can be more than one component of the deformation space, and when there can be more than one homotopy type of three-manifold. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take an oil drum, and there's going to be N slots in my oil drum. And in the first slot, I'm going to take a disc, and I'm going to attach a one handle to it. So in the second slot, a disc with two one handles, all the way down to N one handles. One, two, and that's a two complex, not a three manifold. Mn is just a regular neighborhood of Xn. Now, how much might you make a manifold which is homotopy equivalent to Mn, but not homeomorphic? Well, you might be walking along with your oil drum, and you might drop the oil drum. When you drop the oil drum, all the discs fall out, and you're in a hurry because you forgot your passport, and you've got to get to the airport. and you know, you just get the oil drum and you stick the discs back in. You know, and there's some permutation here. There's sort of tau of one up there, you know, tau of two, blah blah blah, etc. And we're gonna call this M tau of N, where tau is just some permutation. Now, of course, they're still homotopy equivalent, because after all, if you take, you can collapse down to the oil drums, or the oil drums union the discs, And now if I collapse the oil drum to the circle, in each case, I get the exact same homeomorphism type of two complex. So I can collapse the same homeomorphism type of two complex, therefore they have the same homeomorphism type. Now why should they be different? Well, if you think about it, let's just do simplest example. So if I'm over here and I do 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm over here and I do 1, 3, 2, 4, I only mess up the middle two. Well, how are we going to tell that they're not homeomorphic? Well, let's look at what's the dumbest way for things not to be homeomorphic if they don't even have the same boundary components. So what are the genus of the boundary components? There's one around the outside, which has genus 5, between level 1 and 2, genus 3, genus 5, genus 7. What about over here? Around the outside, genus 5, 4, 5, 6. Different genus boundary components, they're different manifolds, homeomorphism types of manifolds. Now what it turns out is that in fact, cal A of Mn is equal to Sn, the coset Sn mod Zn. Because obviously if I take this guy and I crank one over the top and put it on the bottom, I get the same homeomorphism type. I can imagine my oil drum being a conveyor belt. But that's the only way you can get the same homeomorphism type. So in particular, if you look at the interior of AHMN, this is an example which has n minus 1 factorial components. Okay, and you can see very concretely all the different homeomorphism types. So maybe it'll come up in Ken's talk in the mini course. It turns out that all these components intersect one another. The closures of these components intersect one another. And so this was sort of the first example where one started seeing that this space, AH of M, was really quite pathological. Three. Well, Jeff and I need to have a little conversation about that. What I need to at least set the scene and carefully define everything that comes in the lamination conjecture. I also didn't get to talk about some of the corollaries in the conjecture. So I will definitely do that. So I can do that, and I can then do a half that and half a proof ending lamination conjecture. Let's get started. Which Jeff, well, anyway. So I would vote for the second option. Jeff's back there voting too. I could do a half of the setup and elimination here, and half when I talk about all force measure conjecture and some of the analytic stuff. How does that sound? Okay, I'll do that. I've talked about ending lamination conjecture too much, and I haven't talked about the proof of the all force measure conjecture in a long time. So it'll be more fun for me anyway. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this homeomorphic too. Yeah. Oh, this disjoint union. Yeah. Sorry. There's a bunch of components, and each of those components is identified with a quotient of the appropriate Teichmuller space. So if M has incompressible boundary, which just think about the incompressible boundary case, then in that case, each component is just a Teichmuller space. So you have a bunch of balls. And the first question you might ask is, do those balls bump into each other? And it turns out they do, and you know exactly when they do, and there's a whole theory of that. But, yeah. Well, yeah. So this is, Martin and Sullivan said that they sort of fill out the interior, and this really combines Martin and Sullivan and the all fours bears machinery, a little bit of work of Maskin and Craw, and of course Thurston's geometrization theorem. So in some sense, this encapsulates much of 60s and 70s Kleinian group is all in that statement. Yeah, sorry.